I'm in Danuta's sitting room with her here in East London. Thank you very much, Danuta. So I wanted to ask you, what started it for you? What set you out on the spiritual journey?
That's an interesting question, isn't it? One can always go right back to birth, I guess. My parents were Buddhist, and I was born in Malaysia. But interestingly enough, both of them, despite being Buddhist, they went to mission schools, so Catholic schools, themselves. And they thought that we should go, my brothers and I, to Catholic schools as well. So all of us went to Catholic schools. So we practiced sort of Chinese Buddhism at home. Something quite interesting thing about going to Catholic school, it's not that I was very interested in Catholicism. I think there's something that gets, transmitted about how religion is important in one's life. I think that's what I mainly learned from school. So Buddhism's always been around in my life, and something about the importance of religion. When I first came to Triratna, I was working in the city, quite far away from my upbringing, I guess. I'm quite far away from the kind of religious-tinged life, I guess.
What were you doing?
I was an investment banker, working at an American bank, quite close to... this is the sector of banking that I worked in was quite... Well, it was pretty much the epicenter of the financial crisis, the one that happened in 2007-2008. And... I guess I was just looking for something more.
So it was would you say that financial crisis was part of the catalyst?
Yeah, and somehow came back to something I had growing up in Malaysia. Yeah.
Hmm.
Yeah. So I grew up in Malaysia, studied and worked in London, and then went back to something. So kind of like went back to my roots a bit.
Mm. Mm. Mm-hmm. And then how did you come across Triratna?
I picked up a flyer for the LBC winter retreat at this yoga place that I was going to. So it's just one of those flyers that they used to print out and put around Bethnal Green, I guess. And somebody must have put a stack at the yoga place in East London. And I picked one up and I thought I would go. It was more that I didn't mind that it was Buddhist, rather than I was looking for Buddhism.
So what were you looking for?
I think I was looking for a cheap yoga retreat, which it clearly wasn't. So I was hoping for a yoga retreat. It clearly wasn't, but I convinced myself that it was. And then found my way back to Buddhism.
So was the retreat the first Triratna thing that you did?
It was, yeah. Yeah, so I never meditated before. I'd never been on retreat before. And I booked onto a 10-day retreat over Christmas and New Year. Yeah, completely brand new. Never even heard of the London Buddhist Centre. Yeah, I used to go to a Chinese Buddhist temple just off Oxford Street. That's where I would go when I was really desperate, like close to exam time. I go and petition Kuan Yin. Yeah.
So tell me a bit about that retreat and what it was like arriving there and what happened.
So in those days, the retreat was held at Sidford, and
that's a school.
It's a Quaker boarding school in Oxfordshire, I think. So I don't know what I quite expected. I suppose I was working very, very hard in the city. And I just sort of think about it architecturally. So the city's very much, you have these really old buildings like St. Paul's around you, but everything else that's new is all steel and glass. Mm. And then going from that environment where I was in, sometimes over 100 hours a week, into the Oxford countryside, into this really, really old and quite run-down Quaker boarding school, I just really didn't know what I'd done. I think I was in a bit of shock when I arrived there. And it was in the middle of winter, so it was really dark as well. But when I arrived, so I put down my bags and wandered into the communal area for tea, and I met Subhadramati. So she was one of the first people I had a conversation with, and she did this thing. She said she's never ever done it before or after, but she asked me if I would like to see the shrine room, and I said yes. So she took me to a different building where the shrine room was, and it was basically the school hall converted into quite a big shrine room. And the moment she opened the door and I saw the Buddha, I felt fine. I was really, really anxious, and then I saw the Buddha and I felt, it's okay, it's going to be okay. Yeah. That was just really magical, actually. A couple of years ago, Subhadramati publicly ordained me. So it's something about completing that circle. It's the first conversation I had that was meaningful with somebody in Sri Ratna. Now, within the first hour of contact, I guess, she shows me the Buddha, and then some years later, ordains me.
That was 2014.
That 2016.
So Subhadramati was the first Buddha member you really met.
I think so. Yeah, and possibly, you know, Amaravadra was driving the van when that picked us up from the station, and maybe Manjusia welcomed me. And he must have. But I think, yeah, Subhadramati was the first person I had a meaningful conversation with, I think.
And what was your impression of her or what? Just, I'm interested in, yeah, the first order member that people really meet like that. And
I just thought she was very strange. Yeah, I just thought, this is a very strange woman. Strange looking. And just unusual. Yeah, I just thought she was very unusual. I think probably I just thought that everyone I met on that retreat was very unusual.
It was a very different world.
It was a very, very different world. One of the things I've been thinking about the city is that just the amount of time and energy spent on looking good. So all the time that people spend on their hair and clothes, and so this is a completely different world from that. There's not something that... It's really the lack of anything being presented. I think I came from a world where it was all about presentation.
Mm.
It's all about how you present to the world. And then suddenly I was in a world that wasn't. Not in that sort of way. And nobody was trying to sell me anything. Nobody was trying to convince me about anything.
So what was the effect of that retreat? Sort of coming back, and how did it affect your life, I suppose?
It hugely affected my life. So I'd never been to the London Buddhist Centre before, and I very, very much wanted to go. I mean, I was a bit scared of Bethnal Green.
Why was that?
I don't know. Again, maybe perhaps it's to do with architecture. When I first came to London, because I studied at Imperial College in West London, so the London that I was familiar with was just Kensington and Fulham, very, very sort of salubrious areas. And Bethnal Green didn't feel like that. It felt a bit like that was kind of mug me. Actually, in fact, I used to eventually plow my way to the Friday evening class, and there used to be these sort of teenagers that would hang out outside the Buddhist Centre, and occasionally they used to proposition me. 10:30 after a double meditation in puja.
But you carried on going.
I carried on going. It took me some time to find my way into coming to the London Buddhist Centre regularly. Partly I was still working a lot. Very, very difficult for me to get away to come to lunchtime classes or evening classes. Buddhist Centre wasn't regularly open on the weekends in those days. But I'd come on day retreats. And eventually I worked out a pattern of coming on Friday evenings. So that was the only day I could leave work reasonably early, because everyone would want to congregate down at the pub. That's what, I guess, city workers do. They work very hard, and then on Friday evening, everyone knocks off at 5, and we go down to the pub. So I go down to the pub with my colleagues and drink my cranberry juice, and and then I go to the Buddhist Center and meditate. I actually told my colleagues that that was where I was going, and they used to tease me. They used to say things like, oh, just enjoy your levitation. Yeah.
So that was a practice class in the slot. It's all practice, but I mean in the sense that there wasn't actually Dharma teaching. It was meditation.
Meditation and puja.
But not particularly taught or...
Yeah. And I tried to go away on retreat. That's the other thing. I basically stopped going on holiday and just went away on retreat a lot. I think it really changed my life in all ways. Though it took some time to work its way through.
So how did you come to ask to join the order?
So it took me some time to become a Mitra, partly because it took me time to sort of find my way into the Buddhist Center. But almost immediately after I became a Mitra, I started thinking about ordination. And I really remember the point when I decided to ask for ordination. I was sitting on the bus in South London on a quite a long sort of bus journey, and I was talking to somebody, and I found myself saying something like, well, I would like to get ordained, but I would like, you know, I just want to have my career first. And then when I'm done with my career, then I will get ordained and put my life into, really commit to Dharma life and Dharma work. And as I was speaking, I realized how silly that was, because probably by the time I finished working, I'd be so tired. I would not have any energy left in me, because my work was so consuming. I'd be thoroughly burnt out, and then where would I get that energy to pursue a Dharma life? In a way, the best years of my life would have been spent. And just saying all this, I think I just had this moment of realizing that I was rehearsing excuses. I was rehearsing excuses. And that actually deep down, what I really wanted, what I really wanted was to put my energy into serving the Dharma. Here was this version of the Dharma that I could really understand. Yeah, that really made sense. In a way, when I was growing up, what we practiced as Buddhism at home was ethics and reverence, I guess. Yeah. So ethics and then making offerings, doing puja. There wasn't that bit in between of like Dharma or meditation even. So I had the first bit and then the last bit. the path in between wasn't clear. And my Chinese wasn't good enough to learn Buddhism in Chinese. I think coming to Tri Ratna, suddenly there's a translation that I could really understand. And I wanted to be part of making that my life and making it available.
So did you get that sense of the Dharma and meditation on that first retreat?
On the first retreat, I remember it very, very clearly. We were looking at parables from the White Lotus Sutra. So just lots and lots of stories and people talking about their lives. I felt so alive on that retreat. And I learned to meditate. I remember very clearly the first meditation session. Maja Bandhu was teaching meditation. It was 22nd of December, probably at 7 a.m. 2007. And he was trying to teach, and I was trying to learn. And I fell asleep, and I opened my eyes, and there was the sunrise. And that's all I remember. I don't actually remember meditating or counting my breath, but I just remember him speaking and me falling asleep, waking up, opening my eyes, and just watching the sun turn the sky pink.
But you did learn to meditate.
Eventually. I think it took me quite a long time. I think for about 6 or 8 months, I was probably doing the mindfulness of breathing in a really confused way. I wasn't quite sure when to count, you know, which stage to count at. There was trying, I think. That was the main thing, that I was making an effort.
So you are invited to be ordained in 2016. So how was the ordination process for you?
I asked for ordination relatively early in my contact with Tri Ratna. So I think about 3 months, 3 or 4 months after becoming a Mitra, I wrote my request for ordination.
When did you become a Mitra?
When did I become a Mitra? I think it must have been 2009.
Right.
So Westsap 2009. And then September, October, around then, I wrote my ordination request. So I suppose in many ways I didn't really know what I had asked for. It was very much just working it out. as I went along. Fairly soon after, I left my job in the city, and just for a few months, in little ways, I tried out different Tri Ratna institutions, or tried to try out different Tri Ratna institutions. I toyed with the idea of doing a Karuna appeal. I didn't in the end, I was just too scared. But I did go to Buddha Field and be on a crew for a festival. I cooked at different events. I went to Eco Dharma just to see what it was like. I did a solitary there. I think I wanted to find out more about what I had asked to join after I asked to join it. And then I wanted to try out living in the community. After I asked for ordination, I was asked to be on retreat team. So I was on a retreat team for one of the big winter retreats, the same retreat that I'd come to a couple of years earlier. And that really sparked off something. Even though I found being on the team difficult, I realized that I wanted to live and work with other Buddhists. I sort of tried it out in different forms. Tried living with Buddhists and eventually moved into a community.
And is that where you live now?
Yeah, it's still where I live now. Yeah.
Could you maybe say a bit about that? What's it like?
Oh, it's just great. So I really wanted to live in community, and what happened was I tried out living in community for 3 months while somebody was away on a team at the Kashavana, and they sublet their room to me. And that coincided with the period of, going to Buddha Field, having left my job, and, went on this, mini round-the-world trip, ending up at Eco Dharma. I think I just tried to throw myself in to being fully in the community. And not working at that time was good as well. So not having to rush off in the mornings and being around to be part of something. And I made friends. I think, temperamentally, I'm a bit shy. So it is hard for me to get to know people. I don't feel like I get to know people quickly. I don't feel like I kind of let myself be known very quickly either. So living with people was such a boon for me. That there was this kind of structure in Tri Ratna where you could just live with people and get to know people slowly. Slowly reveal oneself and slowly let other people reveal themselves to me. So I live in a big women's community, about 12 of us, that's attached to the London Buddhist Centre. And eventually I found a permanent place in that community. I wanted to say as well that at the moment, I live with both my private and public preceptor. That's probably quite unusual in Tri Ratna. Although it's probably quite a traditional way to live.
Yes. So you got Dramati as your public preceptor and your private preceptor?
Mudhitashri. Mm. Yeah, I wanted to say that, I don't know, sometimes I tell people about it, and perhaps the response can be like, wow, that's intense. Or, I'm not sure if I want that for myself. I don't know. Something like that.
So what is it like living with your public preceptor and your private preceptor?
It's great. It's great. It's really, really good. They're so positive and encouraging. And I get so much help. Yeah, and it's not, obviously it's not as if their whole attention's focused on me 100% of the time. There are other people in the community as well. They've got lives. And I've got lives. But it's so beneficial just having them around. Just, not just to bounce ideas off, but I do, but just be constantly in touch with somebody who holds an ideal for me. Mm-hmm. So in that way, I'm constantly in touch with my ideals. I think sometimes when people say, oh, that's intense, I think they must imagine I get feedback all the time or something like that. But it's not actually. What I get all the time is just very positive encouragement.
Yeah. It's a bit like taking darshan in the traditional sense.
Yes. But that's taking darshan comes in all forms, brushing teeth together. Yeah.
So how many of you live in the community?
So there are 12 of us. It's two Victorian terraces side by side. Each of us have our own room in this community. It feels like quite a mature incarnation of the community. Yeah, last night we had a discussion about lovers and having boyfriends and girlfriends over.
You can imagine those discussions to be quite fractious, and you know, different people wanting different things, and that actually was just very joyous. And we laughed a lot, and yeah, talked openly and honestly.
So who else do you live with?
So Subhadramati and Mulitashri, Dhammadina, Abhayanandi, a mentor called Steph, and then there's Ruta, Sarah Nixon, who's just moved in with us, Holly, who's going off to get ordained in a few months, Joe Goldschmidt, and then the Lamini and Crystal Sara. So it's kind of a community of order member and mitras and myself mixed.
And what's a typical day or week in the life of, in community life like?
Oh, I think because we're such a big community and all of us have quite different conditions, it's very, very varied. You know, because some of us are working in team-based right livelihood, some of us work out of the outside Tri Ratna situations, and some of us are retired. So all of us have quite different rhythms and schedules.
Do you meditate together?
I really do think it's an effective and mature community, but we don't meditate together and we don't eat together. Yet, I really believe that we are effective and mature. Yeah, so for example, I don't meditate with the community. So there is a community sit where about half of us go to. I wake up a bit earlier, meditate a bit earlier, and go do my yoga practice. We have a little rota for dinner, so we stay whether we're in or not, and we take on to cook a few times a month, each of us. And dinner is at 7 o'clock, so some of us eat together, some of us don't. We might be teaching classes down at the Buddhist Center, or you know, have other things on in the evening. But at least once a week, we come together for community night, where we do eat together and spend an evening together. And our community nights are very varied. We might check in. We might have big discussions about community, like the one last night about lovers. Or we might do something fun, like celebrate somebody's birthday, or do a dream workshop together. About maybe once a year, once every 2 years, we have a spa evening where we just I don't know, paint toenails and you know, make face masks. You know, quite fun. Yeah, we are a happy community.
So what do you think makes you a community and not just a house share?
I think we genuinely do relate to each other. I guess a technical language would be relating to each other on the basis of one's going for refuge, relating to somebody else's going for refuge. But I suppose maybe we don't necessarily do that in a very formulaic way. Maybe because the community's been going for such a long time and so many people have gone through it, perhaps even several times in its different incarnations. Somehow that tight structure isn't necessarily required. Mm. It all feels much more smooth rather than clunky. No, we do have our clunky moments, but it's much more smooth. Yeah, there's a spirit that animates what we do, and the spirit's very strong. Sometimes I wonder, perhaps because the spirit's so strong, we don't need the structure so much. It's not just that the spirit's strong, it's alive. I think we are very, very fortunate to have people who are experienced in community living with us. So Dhammadina lives with us, and she's lived in many communities sort of right from the start. So she's seen it all in a way. But yeah, it's not as if we all sit there and defer to Dhammadina. She's just sort of one of us. Kalyana Mitrata runs through the community as well. So I live with both my preceptors, but there are other preceptor and preceptee relationships in the community, and KM relationships as well. So like, we're quite enmeshed in that way.
So there's that formal level of connection in terms of Kalyana Mitrata as well. Is it just flowing, like you said, in a way? It's kind of, well, the spirit.
Yeah, there is definitely a formal, vertical, and sort of more horizontal-ish relationships. Well, if you're really fortunate to be living there.
Mm. Yeah. And somewhere along the way, you got married.
Yes. Yeah, I got married. Yeah, that came up in my ordination process quite a bit. In a certain sort of way, I don't really understand it. And I could sort of explain it. But somehow, sometimes I feel like, oh, that's just explanation. A posteriori explanation after the fact.
Maybe you could just say what happened without explaining it.
Yeah. So at some point, after coming along to Sri Ratna, I fell in love with... by that time he was ordained. The first time I met him, he wasn't. We had just been around each other quite a lot. So it's fun to see it. And I really wanted to get married. And think that's the kind of... there's a momentum of that coming through my childhood. So I just didn't have... And I still don't have a conception of a future where I'm not married. It's just, I suppose, very strong. A lot of my family still live in Malaysia. And fairly traditional culture. Yeah, I say that. I don't want to make it sound like my parents are stuck in the dark ages or anything. They're very, very, very modern people as well. And they do try their best to understand. At the same time, I wanted to get married. I still do. I think that felt to me quite hard to explain to my friends in the order at that time. Well, I still don't really know. It feels cultural and also really in me. So it's not as if like it's cultural and something I can just shake off. Anyway, so Majesty and I met, and I was very clear from the start that I really wanted to get married. And he was clear from the start that he didn't want to have children, and that was the basis on which our relationship started. So very odd, you know, like pretty much after our first date, like, by the way, you know, I really want to get married. He's like, yeah, by the way, I really don't want to have children.
did you want to have children?
Not really. I felt like I could be convinced to have children, but wasn't part of what I want. Partly I think I was the youngest in the family. I was really like being the center of attention in that way, so yeah, didn't necessarily want. But yeah, so I wanted to get married, and at that time I was living in community. In fact, it was 6 months into moving into my permanent spot in the community when Manjusia proposed. Anyway, he was living in a closed men's community just down the road, above the London Buddhist Centre, and I was living in an open women's community. And that was the situation when we first got married, that he was living in the community and I was living in the community. Eventually, for various reasons, he moved out of community. And then we bought a flat together. And I still live in the women's community, and he's now living in Padmaloka. I think very much the basis of our marriage is that we are trying to work out how we can best live our lives. What's the best way in which we can live out our dharmic ideals, our dharma lives in a way, but in a way just life.
So have you ever lived together?
No. I would like us to live together, but I don't want that to be the end point, like as if the goal was for us to live together. Mm. I think it would be good for us to live together at some point, but open to the possibility that we might then live apart again. And I think what marriage probably gives me is a sense of security. Often I think that's one of the things that I work with most in my own life, in my own process, the sense of having security and that there's no security to be found anywhere in the world. At the same time, if that's not enough security in my life, I would find it very hard to practice. Manjusri has given me a family in London, or a family in the UK. You know, his family.
And so you have a connection with his family?
Yes.
Mm. Sort of feels like a certain kind of roots on a certain level connecting with.
Yeah.
And at the same time, you're living in community. And yeah. And you got ordained 2 years ago?
2 years ago, yeah.
Could you say a bit about that?
Yes! So before I got my invitation to go to Akashavana, I felt like I was meditating on the edge of the cliff. Sometimes I had this image of, I think it's Indiana Jones in the Temple of Doom, where he's got to walk across an abyss, and what he has to do is just take the first step into thin air. It's something about that, stepping into thin air. So I felt meditating with that image a lot, and then at some point I got my invitation, and that potency just sort of grew and grew. And so it went from before I got my invitation to, yeah, after I'd come back from Kashavana. A very, very potent time, and a very happy time. So I was at the Kashavana in 2016. Yeah, I think I can still say it was the happiest time of my life. It's quite a funny story, actually. You know, so on my way back, I took a train on my way back from my ordination retreat. And the guy I was sitting next to, from Barcelona to Paris, turned out to be a father of an order member. The Sila Jala's dad. And so it was great talking to somebody who knew something about ordination. He asked me what sort of time I had over my 3 months, and I said it was the best time of my life. And he said something like, "What? You mean it was better than getting married?" And I'm like, "Yeah, definitely better than getting married." Yeah, I was just so happy. Now, Kashavana is just such a magical place. And I got ordained, I got a name. I was introduced to the Buddha, who I took on
as my sadhana practice,
yeah. There was a bit of a retreat after I got ordained where it just felt like every single day I was getting happier. And I couldn't quite believe it. I couldn't quite understand how I could be even happier than the happiest I had been, which was only yesterday.
So could you say a bit about your name, Dani Yuta?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
When you first heard it?
When I first heard it, I was really surprised. Somehow I don't actually think of Dana as a quality I embody.
What does it mean?
Dana. So Dana means generosity, and the Yuta bit is... it means bonded with. So she who is bonded with generosity. So I was a bit surprised, basically. It was quite funny, actually, because that same year, one of my friends got ordained at Gukyaloka, and his name was Dayanatha. And afterwards, I was quite confused between his name and my name. Danaita, Dayanatha. I mean, when we lead things together, which we sometimes do at the Buddhist Center, it's really difficult for the people who are on our courses. yeah, I mean, I loved my name, eventually. Once I could remember what it was.
So you didn't immediately connect with it?
Not really. I think my very first connection with it, the word Dana, it made me think of my parents, actually. It made me think of my mom and dad. And they're incredibly generous people in many ways, not just with their time and money, which they are very generous with, but particularly with their knowledge. My mother taught A-level chemistry, but she's a kind of old school teacher that doesn't just care about whether you learn chemistry or not. She really seems to care about her students' lives, and I think she often tried to teach people about life. Not just chemistry, but how to be a good person. And my dad's very much the same. He works in the steel industry. I think he often tries to mentor younger engineers, formally and informally.
So your name is a connection with your parents?
Yeah, as well.
So you've had your name for a couple of years now. I'm just wondering if you have a sense of what the effect of it has been.
At some point, after I came back from ordination, Sachinama, who's a scholar, I guess, he's interested in scholarly things, he wrote to me about my name. He wrote to me about the Yuta part of my name, and just out of the blue, I don't actually know him very well at all, but he said to me how Utah appears in Pingye's praises, and Pingye's praises is this reading from the Pali Canon. It talks about Pingye being liberated by faith by recollecting the Buddha, and he's never parted from the Buddha day or night. You know, spends his day revering him and his night revering him. And interestingly enough, I really connect with that, like recollecting the Buddha, that sort of that longing, that yearning. I guess it takes me back to when I was a child, and one of my chores before school every day was to make an offering to the different shrines in the house. And to change, you know, make an offering of incense, light the lamps, and change the water.
So how many shrines did you have?
Two, one inside and one outside. And the inside shrines got different levels, and the outside shrines got different aspects. It's a sort of square shrine, and you go around and light each side of the square.
And who was on the shrines?
Kuan Yin and the Buddha. Yeah, and then there was like some Taoist gods, the earth god, as well. But yeah, that was my daily thing, to make sure the offerings were made.
So your connection with the Buddha goes right back to your childhood.
Mm.
Mm. And then you saw the Rupa at Sibford.
Mm-hmm.
And then you were ordained and you took the Shakyamuni practice.
Yeah. Yeah. So
can you say more about the Buddha? What the Buddha means to you?
Well, that's a really hard question. I guess the Buddha holds something. Maybe that's something that reaches across outside space and time. You know, something that's so truly human that is beyond being human. I think it's very, very difficult for me, and I don't know whether it is for other people, but certainly for me, to uphold qualities if they're not embodied. So I find it very difficult to sort of revere kindness, or I don't know, to revere wisdom. But if there's some sort of embodiment, you know, it could be Tara or Majikosha, and I suppose for me it's the Buddha, then it just feels much more real, much more emotional. And I think I love stories. So when Satchanama wrote to me about Pingye's praises, somehow then there was a story to my name. And I just love stories. Mm. Stories sort of make sense of the world.
So how would you describe your Dharma practice? What you actually do? How your life is a Dharma life, I suppose.
That's interesting, isn't it? There's all the outer stuff, and then there's the inner stuff. Yeah, so I live in a women's community. I work at the London Buddhist Centre, and mainly my work there is running a yoga program that's sort of fully integrated with the Dharma teaching program at the Buddhist Centre. So in a certain sort of way, going back to the roots of yoga, we call our program Yoga for Meditation, but also we try to teach quite a bit of Dharma through it as well. I feel like that's just trying to hold a door open for people to encounter the Dharma. Yoga is very, very popular. I guess these days so is meditation, but yoga even more so. It feels like a way that people might encounter something of the Dharma. And then, you know, I lead mantra study, run courses, seminars, grand retreats, and things like that. That sort of feels like all the outer stuff of, you know, serving the Dharma and trying to I don't know, work out Bhante's vision in reality. And then I suppose there's my, I don't really like the term of inner world, but I suppose that's one way to talk about the inner world.
Why do you not like it?
Sometimes I just don't think I have one. I was just a bit of opaque. Again, it could be cultural, you know. Anyway.
So this inner world that you don't necessarily have.
Yeah, the inner world. I'm sure I have it, I'm just not so like fluent in it. Yeah. And I think that's where the connection with the Buddha is alive, the connection with my preceptors, with men and women who I regard as teachers, sort of vertical spiritual friends, where that all gets lived out in my heart. Well, easily, you know, it gets lived out in reality as well. I don't just sort of sit there and think about my friends and never call them. I do, you know, stay in touch. That the inner being in touch with people and being in touch with the Buddha, and through him and through my friends, my ideals. I suppose that I try to cultivate that. Yeah, I suppose it does get cultivated through, you know, trying to communicate the Dharma. But like, for example, I've just been on a 10-day retreat at Taraloka. It was an order retreat on the six element practice. It could have just easily been called an order retreat on sadhana and how to get into sadhana.
Can you say a bit more about that? The retreat.
Yeah, so, it was actually a 9-day retreat. And I don't think it was sort of really thought out. I don't think at all that it was really thought out, but somehow the kind of, you know, we were in silence and the daily program seemed to work out, either sort of officially or unofficially, as doing some body work right early in the morning, the first thing we did together. And I did the mindfulness of breathing and the metta bhavana. And then we did the six element practice mid-morning. In the afternoons, we did puja and chanting. And in the evenings, we did sadhana. And it somehow felt absolutely right, like on the basis of being in touch with our direct physical experience. We try to dissolve the illusion of control over experience. And then we call on the Buddha and he appears. And I suppose it really felt to me that he did. Well, it was very, very hard to talk about, isn't it? You know, imagination and what happens in sadhana, and whether that's just an image. But sometimes it becomes more than three-dimensional. In a certain sort of way, even more than four-dimensional. I don't know if that makes sense.
It's making me think about what you were saying about the community.
Oh, yeah.
And the way the structure of the community isn't rigid. Mm. The spirit is very strong and alive.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wonder if there's a sense of resonance
with that.
With them? May not be. When you're saying it's more than four dimensional, it's.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Well, I suppose I'm quite new to my visualization practice, so maybe I'm trying to navigate that the structure, blue sky, and then, you know, building up the visualization and all that. That kind of like. Do this, and then do that, and then do that, and do that. The step-by-step guide to visualization of a Buddha or Bodhisattva. And really, really letting it be animated and, I don't know, let loose, let rip. Yeah, and I think because it's new to me, something I've been doing it for less than 2 years, just trying to learn that, I suppose. I suppose with retreats, it's very hard to know, like, the effect of retreat, even on it or coming off it. But it really took me back to my ordination retreat, and it reminded me of a couple of things that people have said to me. Now, I'm sure it's like things that people had said to them, but something about a lot of what happens post-ordination is the working out of one's ordination. That was one thing I was thinking about. And then the other thing I was thinking about was somebody had said to me that on one's ordination retreat, depth charges are planted, and you never know when they're going to go off. And just like blow your world apart again. Something of that was evoked through just being on that retreat, just gone. A further working out of my ordination retreat, and perhaps a depth charge, I don't know, was ignited, went off. Not sure yet.
So do you have a sense that your life's been blown apart in this process that you started practicing since you came across Truman?
Yeah, for sure. You know, in many ways. And that's that's been a process, you know. I was just thinking about my parents when you said that. And it's like I said, they're quite traditional. They really wanted the best for me. They gave me this incredible education that was, you know, very high quality and expensive. I was set up with a big career, and that's all gone now. It's quite difficult for my parents. So that's sort of blowing apart. But also, I don't know, just new growth. I think I feel like, you know, 10 years down the line, I sometimes think, just from what my parents say to me, that they're beginning to see the fruits of it. I think a lot of my life now is obviously very different from my life when I had first come to Triratna. Yeah, so I was working in an investment bank just at quite the start of the financial crisis. It had been a difficult year, but it was about to get a lot more difficult. I was earning quite a lot of money, and now I don't. Yeah, now I don't. I mean, I'm still quite hardworking and busy. Just don't expect to be well compensated for it. So when I worked as a banker, one's pay, so your monthly salary plus your bonus that you get, what it's called in the industry is compensation, as if to compensate for the life that you never lived that year. So now, working for the London Buddhist Center, what I get, again, it's not my wages. What I get in, like, financially, is not called wages, but it's called support. That's quite a different, like, it's a completely different paradigm, compensation and support.
Did you miss anything about your old life?
Yeah, I mean, I still do miss things about my old life. My favorite job was when I worked for a big American bank. It doesn't even exist anymore, you know, post-financial crisis. It was a very big team, very, very international. I think there was about 68 of us, and
what,
you know,
were you
40
doing?
Different nationalities. Basically, my job involved helping other banks raise money from their mortgage portfolios. And banks like Northern Rock. It doesn't really exist anymore in its old form. I think, yeah, just thinking about the American bank, it was a very collegiate environment. I remember when I first started going to Triratna Loka, after my first retreat, I was so relieved to be back in the bank, because at least people weren't asking me how I felt all the time. You could just go to work, no one's going to ask you how I feel. And that felt like a real relief. I mean, obviously, I wouldn't really enjoy that now. I think if I went to work and nobody asked me how I was, I wouldn't like that very much. And partly because I wasn't very in touch with myself. I wasn't used to being in touch with myself. I think sometimes I miss the pace. So I kind of used to live on the trading floor. I worked so much. But
did you
use
pay or the pace?
Pace. Yeah, the pace. I used to work on the trading floor, and that was quite exciting. So I missed that.
So what happens on the trading floor, actually? I mean, you hear this phrase, but I don't know what it really means. What's it like?
It was like a really big trading floor. So there were about three of us, and then two floors, so 600. 300 of us, and then two floors, so 600 of us. And so it's a mixture of people who trade stuff, so it could be bonds or shares or currency or stuff like that. And then salespeople, so people who actually do the trades, the salespeople who broker the trades, and then people like me who structure the trades, so make sure that they actually work in real life and make sure that the contracts say what people intend. And then quants who do the maths wizardry behind it. And then all the things that you need to support that, like administrators, business managers. And then we all sat together on these very, very big floors. I don't know if you can imagine one big room for 300 people. You know, people sitting in rows and banks of computers. TV screens everywhere showing different news channels. Most of the time, sometimes in summer, we watch the cricket instead. There's something very energizing and alive about being around so many people and high energy. And I worked for a team that was very good. Yes, that was very international. People were generally very nice. Mostly people were just trying to earn enough money to educate their children. Obviously, there's like a difference in what one thinks one might need to do that. But yeah, regular people. We spent a lot of time together because we worked such long hours. So I did get to know people very well.
So what hours would you normally work?
So I tried to be at my desk at 8:05. My boss would come in, sometimes earlier than me. Sometimes, I think 8:20 was our official, the latest you can be at your desk. And it could be any time to leave, really. So Fridays would be the earliest, 5:36. And most nights might be about 2 a.m.
2 a.m.?
Yeah, or 11 a.m. 11 p.m.
You'd work from 8 in the morning till
2 a.m.
to the following morning?
Yeah.
About 18 hours?
Yeah, sometimes. It's quite a lot, isn't it?
Yeah.
when we were doing deals, and obviously we had a few going. But I think if I left at 11, that would be a good night. And a bad night could be worse.
And then you had to get home?
Got home, shower, sleep.
Go back,
yeah. I mean, I used to think of myself quite fortunate because I didn't actually have to pull any all-nighters. I think only just once, and I went home and slept for 40 minutes. That was the worst. 40 minutes, it might be better not to because you wake up feeling very sick. Yeah, it's crazy. But also, you know, when you're 23, it feels exciting.
You were 23 when you were doing this.
I was 23 when I first started. Yeah. But I really loved it. I really love closing deals. I remember after my first deal, I was just skipping to work. Uh-huh. I really loved it. And generally, by and large, I've worked for very good people. People who are smart. And I think often we can think of people who work in banking or finance as being very utilitarian. Mm. But they weren't, actually. No, they weren't. I think I felt very, very valued most of the time.
Mm.
Valued and appreciated and brought on.
Mm.
You know, the same sort of thing that we try to do in our spiritual community, to appreciate people, to bring people on.
And in a particular context with particular values.
Yeah.
So how old were you when you stopped?
I think I was 27. Yeah. So I started at 23 and I quit my job just before a few months before my 28th birthday. I did go back for a year after a break. But yeah. Yeah. Maybe like short but bright.
And how old are you now?
I'm 35. I think I had, just going back to my career, I had this idea in my head that you kind of go through the ranks, and I had this idea in my head about being a particular rank by a particular age.
So what was that exactly that you wanted?
I wanted to be a vice president by 27. And I was. And I was. So I felt like I had ticked my ultimate checkbox.
By the age of 27.
Yeah, in that career. Yeah. It's funny, because I looked around me and looked at the women around me who were more senior than that. You know, directors, managing directors. And then I don't think I actually really saw anyone I wanted to become. I think that was one of the things that made me leave. What was available wasn't very attractive, in terms of just being a person, I think.
So how old were you when you went on that first Siddhartha retreat?
So that was 2007, so I must have been 25.
Oh, right, so right in the middle of all this.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I'd like to ask you one final question, if I may. Quite a big question.
Mm-hmm.
What does going for refuge to the Three Jewels mean to you?
For me at the moment, I feel that the most important aspect of that, something with different aspects, but the most important aspect of that is that going for refuge needs to be enacted and lived out in my life. Yeah, so not just an idea or something that I think this is possibly what I thought when I had become a mitra. Something that I do on evenings and weekends. But that going for refuge needs to be enacted and lived out year by year, month by month, week by week, day by day, and sort of moment to moment. I suppose that would be the ideal, that kind of every single microsecond I enact and live out, moving more towards the Buddha, actually trying to live in accordance with the Dharma, and moving closer to the Sangha, whether it's the enlightened Sangha or just other people. I should say just other people. Like that, but you know what I mean? Other beings. And that feels to be the most important thing, that it's actually lived out. Not just an idea or a concept or a sort of nice philosophy, like a nice sentiment. Mm-hmm. That one can sort of trot out at cocktail parties. Not that I go to any more cocktail parties anymore.
Is that part of the
old life? Yeah. Yeah, so, you know, like not just a nice sentiment, but something that's actually done.
Thank you very much.